Welcome to the Young Entrepreneur's Journey with your host, Yasmina Ellens.
Welcome to the Young Entrepreneur's Journey, where we take the skills, mindset, and attitude needed to achieve any entrepreneurial endeavor, whether you're just starting out or you're already on your journey. And now, our host, Yasmina Ellens.
Hello and welcome back to the Young Entrepreneur's Journey podcast with your host, Yasmina Ellens. Now, you are here today because you want to live the best life that you possibly can and become financially free. And we all know that the best way to achieve what you want is to model someone who's already achieved it. Now, today I'm chatting with John Sonmez, who through sheer discipline and hard work retired as a multimillionaire at the age of 33. Now, when he achieved his dream of financial freedom, he fell into an unexpected depression, and he managed to climb his way out of this by learning what it means to be truly fulfilled. Today, he has three businesses, and he's a champion of mental toughness. He's extremely fit, and he loves to run marathons. Most notably, John is the founder of Bulldog Mindset, where he teaches men to become financially independent, get the physique they want, and get the girls they want. Now, women can learn a lot from him as well. Through his brand, John empowers people to transform themselves to reach their highest potential in life. By the end of this interview, you will have the tools and the mindsets you need to accomplish your biggest goals and dreams. You will gain insight into how to build true mental toughness and a bulldog mindset, and you will feel that you too can live the life you truly want to live. Thank you so much for coming on, John. I'm really excited for this chat and I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That was an excellent intro. I have to take some notes on that because that was pretty good how you got that set up there. I need to do a little bit better job when I intro people. So
thank you. Yeah, feel free to use it for any and all marketing purposes. Awesome. So I'd love to know what originally got you onto your entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah, so it's weird. It's not like a path I charted out. I didn't really plan on becoming an entrepreneur. Not really. You know, I had tried to do some entrepreneurial things as I was younger. I think the first really entrepreneurial thing I did was I created a Palm Pilot application, actually. That was it was this life counter for this card game called Magic the Gathering. Back in the day, and I figured out a way to sell it online through PayPal for like $5 to register it. But I wasn't really thinking entrepreneurial. I was just thinking, okay, this is interesting. I could do this thing, and I started writing blog posts. I started a blog for software developers called Simple Programmer, and I just was writing blog posts just to almost like passive aggressively talk about things that were happening in my work environment, because I knew my coworkers would read it and my management would read it. And so that I could communicate my thoughts better without getting into arguments because it's written down. And that blog started to get popular. And so I got some invites to be on some podcasts, developer podcasts and things like that. And then that's when the wheel started turning, because I kept getting all of these opportunities because I had built up this blog and started to get this audience. And so that made me start to think about, you know, I started reading some books on marketing and sales, because at this point I had this audience and I was like, well, what can I do with this? You know, I don't want to just run ads on this website. And so I was the first doing some affiliate links on the blog on Amazon. And I remember making my first $5, and I was just like, I was thrilled when I made $5 on an affiliate link, even though I was a software developer making $100,000 a year. It was that money that was the most appealing to me, because it was all my own, because I had done it by myself. No one had helped me do this. And so that's where really, I think that, you know, I got that feeling of wanting to, you know, feel like I created something on my own, that I didn't just get a paycheck. And, you know, from there, you know, I launched forward and created a course and started selling that. And I created some courses for this company called Pluralsight. I ended up writing a book and all of these things, you know, I found myself. And it was funny, because I think for the first 3 or 4 years, even after I quit my regular job, I would not call myself an entrepreneur, because I didn't feel like I was an entrepreneur. And then at some point, I just kind of had this realization. I was talking to one of my coaching clients yesterday, and I was like, because I was talking about identity, and I was like, you know, at some point, I just realized like I was doing all the things that entrepreneurs do. I was making all my money from entrepreneurial efforts. Therefore, I must be an entrepreneur, and that identity shifted. But it took a while for it to shift because I didn't really set out thinking I was going to become an entrepreneur.
Yeah, it's interesting because you started this thing and then suddenly some doors opened. You're like, oh, this door looks interesting. Let me go through that. And then some more doors opened. You're like, oh, let me check out some of these doors. And it's like the opportunities just kept building on each other, which is it's really cool the way something like that can happen. And something I'm really curious about is someone might have listened to the introduction, think, wow, he retired at 33. That's very young. I mean, that obviously comes with a lot of work, you know, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. Is that something that you planned out? Like, what does it really take to become retired at such an early age?
Yeah. So, well, starting out when I was younger, my dream was to retire young. That's what I wanted to do. Now, what my plan was to sit on the beach and drink Mai Tais and then play video games all day. So I could just have time to do that, whatever I wanted to do. That wasn't a great plan, but that was my dream. I didn't want to work. You know, I didn't want to work. I wanted to like relax. That was the idea. And so, and again, I didn't realize back then that was not the right motivations, but that's what I wanted. And so I remember, you know, what actually happened was I got this really good job when I was about 19 or 20 years old as a software developer. I got this offer to move to Santa Monica, California, and start working for like $75 an hour with some of it per diem. So it was like this ridiculous, you know, dream job. I was underqualified for the job, but they just gave me this job. And so I moved to California. And I remember getting there, and I thought, you know, being 19 or so, that I was rich, right? And so I started just doing the math in my head. And I was like, okay, well, you know, when will I become a millionaire? And so, you know, I figured, okay, I'm making like maybe $160,000, $170,000 a year equivalent. And then if I save as much money as possible after I pay taxes, maybe I could save $100,000 a year, right? I was actually sleeping on a mattress on the floor and eating macaroni and cheese, even though I was making a ridiculous amount of money, because that was my plan, right? I really wanted to do this. And so I did the math and I said, well, I mean, if I just save $100,000 a year, it'll take me 10 years to become a millionaire. And I thought, wow, this is just insane. And then I factored in inflation and I was like, okay, so it's more like 14 years or so. And even if I invested and got, you know, a 10% interest rate on that money, that's still not going to make much of a difference. It's still going to be about the same time span. It's going to be somewhere between 10 and 14 years. And I thought, I have to keep this job. I have to sleep on this mattress on the floor. I have to keep on eating at Payless or whatever, you know, grocery Sack and Save grocery store. And I have to like sacrifice for all this time for 10 years just to become a millionaire. And I thought, this doesn't make any sense. There has to be a better way. And so I started researching and trying to figure out how do people make money? How do people become wealthy? And it came down to real estate. I found that most of the wealth that was created in America was real estate, and in the world really was real estate. And so that's when I started looking into investing in real estate and started buying. My plan was to buy a property every year. And so that's what I ended up doing is I ended up buying a property every year, and I did the math on it. And see, this is the thing. Most people don't do the math, right? So one of the things I always talk about in with my coaching clients and in my Bulldog Mindset membership is to play with a compound interest calculator. I feel like if people did that more, then they would understand and they'd be able to answer that question of how do you retire young and what does it take? Because you need to know what the numbers are. So many people, their plan is like, I'm just gonna put money in my 401k, or I'm just gonna save a bunch of money, or whatever it is, or this investment, but they're not actually doing the math. But if you do the math, if you take a compound interest calculator, and that's what I had done, you know, at that early age, is you can check it out. You can say, okay, well, if I start with X amount of dollars, okay, because there's three variables, right? There's initial investment, there is the interest, the return that you're making on that investment, and then there's the time span. Okay. And compound interest is great if you have two of those three things. Okay. But if you don't, the compound interest is worthless. It's not going to help you. It takes way too long. So if you have a lot of time, for example, you could have a really low interest rate and you could have a small amount of money or a decent amount of money. And if you have 100 years to compound that, you can make a huge amount of money. If you think about wealthy families, like true generational wealth, the reason why a lot of bankers like Rothschilds and want to have so much money is because of compound interest over a very long period of time. That adds up a lot. If you have a very high return and you have a lot of money to start with, that can add up. But the whole point is like to just do the exercise and figure out, okay, if I'm saving or investing this much money, and if I'm getting about this rate of return and I have this many years, well, then you can see how many years will it take you to actually hit the amount that you need to retire. And for most people, what I say is that the amount that you need to retire is about $3 million. If you have about $3 million, because you can always convert net worth into cash flow, right? So I can always take net worth that I have and I can get some kind of return on that. And then that I can live off of. That's true wealth. And so you kind of have to work from that. You got to say, okay, well, how much money do I want to have per month? Okay. As retired. And when I say retired, I don't mean that you don't necessarily live on the beach and just don't work anymore. What I mean is that you're financially independent. So you have money that you don't have to work. You have money coming in that will sustain your lifestyle for the rest of your life. That's what I consider to be retired. So you figure out, okay, what is that? How much money do I need per month? Right. And for some people, they're like, yeah, you know, I could live in Thailand. And if I could have $2,000 or $3,000 a month, I'd be a king. I'd be fine. That's cool. Other people are like, you know, I want to retire. I want to be able to fly first class and to stay at nice places. Maybe I need $15,000 or $20,000 a month of passive income, right? Whatever that amount is, but whatever it is, you can calculate that. And then you can calculate from that, what is the return that you could get on money that you invest, that you could like a guaranteed rate of return, you know, and depending on what you want to, how risky you want to take it or how passive you want it to be. It could just be tax-free municipal bonds. It could be real estate and getting cash flow off of that. But once you know that percentage, now you have a couple of pieces of the equation. Now you have to work backwards. And that's where you use the compound interest calculator. And you can figure out, okay, well, how much initial capital do I need to have? You know, what kind of return can I get on my money? And then how many years will it take me to reach that number? And that's the calculation that most people don't want to do because it's scary. Because when you do that, most people that think they have a good retirement plan or that they have a plan to become financially free, when they run those numbers and the compound interest calculator, they find out they're actually pretty short, that it's not going to work. They have to do something different. And that's where entrepreneurship comes in. Most people and what came in for me also when I started running that number, even when I was investing in real estate, is I realized I still need to make more money. I still need something else. You know, I could retire in 30 years. That was initially the plan. And I could have done that, but then if I wanted to accelerate that, I realized I need to actually have more capital to invest. And that's where business and entrepreneurship came in, was a vehicle that allowed me to be able to have enough capital to be able to benefit off of that return that I was making from real estate and to get to where I wanted to get to sooner.
Yeah. I think it's so important how down into the detail you went and how you thought, okay, if this is my goal, what does it realistically take to get there? And then how do I reverse engineer the steps? You know, people talk about, I'm going to reverse engineer the steps, but they don't sit down, as you say, right, do the maths and actually see, do the numbers add up? And does this work out? And will this compound over time? And I think just the amount of strategy, it just goes to show that proper planning and preparation is really key. And then once you've implemented the strategy, you're like, okay, this is a strategy. Now I just need to execute on the strategy. And I think that notion of compound interest is very interesting because it doesn't just apply to money. It also applies to if you take action and you're disciplined and you work, how are all those right actions going to compound over time? If you build the right relationships, how's all that going to compound over time? If you do good things for your health, how's all that going to compound over time? And I think like people really underestimate the effect of that.
Exactly. Yeah. There's actually a really good book called The Compound Effect by Darren Hardy, I believe. And it's really interesting because in that book, he illustrates, I think it's three brothers and the different, slightly different choices that they make, which have because of compounding over time, those life choices end up having very, very different outcomes in their life over, I think it was like a 20 or 30 year span of time. And so you're absolutely right on that. It's so critical. Those little choices, I call it sometimes the knife's edge, right? So the example I use often is just something as little as even calories, right? So if you eat just 100 calories over your maintenance every day, in a year, in a couple of years, you'll become very fat. That's just like eating one extra apple a day or something like that, right? If you eat 100 calories below your maintenance every day, you'll become really thin. Like you'll become ripped. You'll lose a lot of weight over a large period of time. And so it's like that knife's edge. It's not much of a difference. Mm. It's like a 200 calorie span, but over time, you're going to have two completely different outcomes based on that, just that little bit of a change, because those things compound over time. And so it's the same thing with everything in life. It's like these little choices that we make. If we don't know what direction we're going and we don't have an actual plan, then those little choices one way or the other is going to compound over time. And it's going to take you to an exponential effect. That's the thing. We think things are linear, but they're actually exponential.
Yeah, it's like those little, like those thousand, you know, you make like 1,000 micro decisions every day, from like, should I eat the apple or the cake, to like really big things as well. Should I open up Instagram or should I go read a book now? Like, you make all these little decisions and it's all like, do I want to get like 1% better and then exponentially better, or 1% worse and then over time exponentially worse? And one of the things that I think is really interesting, one of these phenomenons of humanity that never ceases to amaze me, is how easy it can be for you to do the things that you don't want to do, mm-hmm. and how difficult it can be to get yourself to do the things that you know you do want to do. So with that in mind, I know you talk a lot about discipline and
oh, I lost you for a second there. I no, the last I heard was you said, I know you talk a lot about discipline.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, how can you get, you know, how can you develop that, right? How can you, if you talk, like, think about follow through, how can you get yourself to do the things that you don't really want to do in the short term to achieve the outcomes that you know you really want in the long term?
Yeah.
And so follow through with yourself.
Yeah. There's a few different strategies. The biggest part of it is just this idea, like you said, there's almost two wills within you, right? The one that has the bigger ideal of what you actually want to do, and then the one that's battling, that's fighting against you because it doesn't feel pleasurable. It's not the thing that's immediately gratifying. And so it's a matter of strengthening the first one, right? So there's a few different ways that I look at this. One of them is understanding some of the principles. So I think a really important principle that everyone needs to understand in life is, or skill that they need to develop, is the ability to work without motivation, right? So most people, what they do, in fact, I was just working with someone, he just emailed me and he was like, I want to quit my sales job because I don't feel motivated by it anymore. And maybe I'll just go home and back to Virginia and live with my mom and become, do Uber and deliver pizza. And I was like, no, you don't quit something just because you don't like it or it's too hard. You quit something because it's the logical choice to quit. It doesn't make sense to do it anymore, not because of those reasons. And that's the thing, is like, and he cited the motivation aspect of it, which so many people do. The thing is, like, no matter what you do, if you want to be great, if you want to do something that's actually going to improve your life, you're going to reach a point where you're not motivated to do it. It's going to become hard and difficult. And most people, they give up and they switch because they feel like it's not their passion. It must not be the thing for them if they no longer love it. In fact, if they hate it. But most of the things that have made me successful in life, I've hated. You know, I've loved them at one point, but then I've hated them and I've had to endure it anyway. So a lot of it is understanding your own human nature, right? Understanding that you will sabotage yourself, right? And really one of the kind of, I try to think of like all these things that make it really life or death for me, extreme. And so one of the, analogies I like to use is, well, my definition of freedom is your ability to execute your will upon the world, right? And so if I have a thought in my head, something that I want to accomplish or do, and I'm unable to do that, if my body rebels, my smaller will rebels against that, and I lack the discipline to do that, then I'm not really in control of my life. Instead, I'm like a pinball in a pinball machine being bounced around. It's really other people, it's circumstances, it's the environment. And so my life isn't really mine, so I might as well be dead. And that's kind of the way that I envision it. I in my mind, I'm able to make things life or death, because I'm like, if I'm not in control, then who is? Not me. I'm just a passenger in the car that someone else is driving. That's my life. And the thing I think about that also is that you have these rare moments of lucidity in your life where it's like the car that is your life that someone else is driving, and you're just in the back seat, where it pulls over and it says, "Hey, do you want to drive for a while?" And you got to make those choices and commitments during that time, because most of your life is on autopilot. Most of our lives are on autopilot. You get into these habits, you get into these routines, and you realize that you're just responding and reacting instead of directing your life. And it's easy to just be asleep the whole time in the backseat of the car and just responding to the environment. And so there's these moments, like maybe people that are listening today, maybe this is one that you're getting this wake up call from the universe that's saying, "Hey, wait a minute. Do you want to drive the car? Because I'm giving you the ability to acknowledge this at this point," because most of your life is going on autopilot, right? And so there's these lucid moments where you have that decision. And when you have that frame of mind where you're lucid and you can see the future that you want and you can see how you can get there, you have to make commitments that will make you do it, right? So if you're listening and you're like, "Well, I've been thinking about running a marathon." Okay, here, let's do it right now. Go to your calendar, put on there, or email yourself right now, put a date on there and say right now, go and call a coach and block out an hour of time that you're going to call a coach and you're going to sign up for a marathon and you're going to start the training program, because that's going to commit you to doing it. Whereas otherwise that thought's going to come up in your head. You're going to listen to this podcast and then it's going to disappear. And then maybe by some random luck, you'll stumble on it again, but maybe you won't, and you won't do that thing in your life. And so I really, you know, view it like that, is that you have these small moments of control. And when you have them, you've got to commit and you've got to make sure that it happens. And so I do a lot of things to remind myself to create strong commitments, because those are the only things that guarantee that I'm actually going to be able to execute the thoughts that I have in my head. And so I take it all very, very seriously, because I want to be in control of my life. I don't want to just be a passenger in the backseat of the car.
Mm. That's really, really powerful. I think it's that moment where you make that decision and you're like, enough. Hmm. Like, I want to have agency. I no longer want to be at the mercy of the environment. And that analogy about the car and being in the back seat and the passenger versus the driver is extremely powerful. And one thing that you were talking about was this idea of self-sabotage. And I think it's, you know, it can be easy for people to think, like, in a lucid moment, they're like, "Yeah, okay, you know, I'm gonna sign up for this marathon and I'm gonna put the date and I've done it, okay, cool." Then it's like two weeks later and you self-sabotage because you're like, "Oh, you know, it'll be fine, and I like donuts, I'll just have one." Yeah. And you know, like, it can be easier for people to self-sabotage, and people don't even realize when they're doing it, right? So why do you think people do that, and how can you overcome that?
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, I think it's just baked into our human nature. It's because it's like I said, we have these lucid moments where we're thinking clearly and we know what we want, right? But then it's like when it's time to pay the price, our judgment is clouded because emotions cloud our judgment. And so we have to separate ourselves from the situation, right? The Stoics are really good about this with Stoic philosophy. It's why it's so valuable, is because if I am making judgment calls, I am going to make bad judgment calls because I have bad judgment, because I am clouded by my own emotion. And so what I want to do is I want to separate that. I want to make rules for myself. I want to prevent myself from having to make judgment calls, because the more that I make, the more that I'm going to make bad judgment calls. And so it's just kind of built into us because of that, because when we're in that moment, you know, when you have to, it's easy if I say, and there's some psychological studies that talk about this, about saving money in the future versus like seeing a picture of your future self. But essentially what it comes down to is that if I say 2 weeks from now, I'm going to start a diet, in my logical mind, I can do that now because I don't have to pay the price. But when it comes down to 2 weeks from now and I wake up and I'm hungry, now I have this emotion. Now I have my judgment clouded and I'm not making a clear judgment. That's why I have to rely on what I did when I made the rule ahead of time. And so with that said, I always think of myself as I know what my future self is going to do, right? We already know our nature. We know that we're going to sabotage ourselves. And so I'm always trying to outsmart my future self. So I think of it as the other analogy I like to use is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, right? So, you know, Dr. Jekyll, what he would do is he knows that he's going to transform into Mr. Hyde and be this crazy beast that's going to destroy everything and kill people and cause all kinds of mayhem. So he would chain himself up, right? So that he can do as little destruction as possible. So we're all Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. We have a Mr. Hyde, right? We're Dr. Jekyll. We're making these smart decisions. I'm going to run a marathon. I'm going to get in shape. I'm going to, you know, really work on the business. I'm going to stop wasting time on Instagram and I'm going to, you know, focus, read more books, whatever it is. We have all these high ideals, but we know that there's a doctor, that there's a Mr. Hyde that's going to come out. So we have to do as much as we can to not allow Mr. Hyde to sabotage and destroy everything that we built, because it takes a lot longer to build things than it does to destroy them, right? To build a skyscraper takes years potentially or a year and so many man hours and so much equipment. But to destroy it, you can destroy a skyscraper in literally 3 minutes with an explosion, right? So that's how our lives are. And most people that don't make progress in their life, it's not because they don't work hard. It's because when they screw up badly. And so my whole strategy is to know that I'm going to eventually turn into Mr. Hyde. And how can I chain Mr. Hyde down as much as possible? What kind of rules can I implement? How can I set future restraints on myself so that when I am in a bad mood, when I'm hungry, when I'm tired, when I'm exhausted, when I don't have motivation anymore, that I'm still going to follow through and do what I need to do? You know, the other analogy I would give you is that of Odysseus, right? When he was sailing back and he was going through the sirens and he told the guys, the men on the ship, he said, tie me to the mast. And, you know, he had them put wax in their ears so they couldn't hear the sirens call. And he said, no matter what I do, no matter what I say, do not untie me from this mast. And right, you know, he goes by the sirens and he says, all right, that's it. Untie me. and they don't, because he's already given them instructions, because he knew that his future self, when he heard the sirens call, that he was going to tell them to untie him. So he made sure he took preventative measures to stop that from happening. And all of us know, we know that our future self is going to sabotage. It's going to be emotional. It's going to make bad judgments. So we have to put in rules. We have to plan ahead of what's going to happen and think of those scenarios. Okay, what's going to happen when you are really hungry and you're tired of this diet? Okay, what's your protocol that you're going to implement to keep you on track? What's going to happen when this scenario, you know, in that scenario? And so I try to plan out these scenarios and then to come up with rules for myself in situations that I already have planned out, so I don't have to make judgment calls. Because if you are in a difficult situation and you have to make a judgment call, chances are you're going to make a bad judgment call. But if you've already thought about the situations that you're going to encounter, because you know what they are, you've already been on diets, you've already tried to do workout programs, you've already tried to, you know, write 2,000 words a day or whatever it is, think about it ahead of time. And you think about some way to prevent yourself from sabotaging yourself in the future by creating a rule, by creating some kind of accountability or other system that's going to prevent you from self-sabotage. But, you know, we keep on doing the same thing and we don't realize why. And it's so you should see the pattern and then do something about it.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it's kind of like Groundhog Day, where it's like suddenly like you wake up and you're like, oh, I've been here before. This is the same day. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, you can see the future because you've already lived the future. It's such a powerful thing. And I'm very curious to know, what are some pre-made decisions or rules that you have in your life that have led to your success?
Yeah. So one of them that I did for a long time, I'm not doing right now as I started training a lot harder, but I'll probably go back to it, is eating one meal a day. So I would fast until 5 p.m. every single day. And I did that for over almost about 5 years. And that was just my rule. And it was great because I didn't have to think about what should I eat for breakfast? Should I eat something healthy or not? Or should I, fast or skip breakfast? It was just the standing rule. And so I didn't have to make any decisions. I just, there it is. Is it 5 o'clock? No, it's not 5 o'clock. Then you don't eat. And that made things simple. Another one is, and I still have, is on my calendar right now. In fact, for today at 3 p.m., it says lift weights. Okay. And it's a recurring meeting on my calendar. And it's been like that for years. And to me, there's no decision about it. It's 3 o'clock. Yeah, it's just like any other meeting. Like, we had this podcast scheduled. I wouldn't say, well, maybe I'll do the podcast. Maybe I'll do this thing I committed to. It's on the calendar. I'm going to show up. I'm going to do it at the time. Same thing, right? So that's a pre-made decision. Another one with my running, right? When I hired a coach to do ultra running last year, I just said, okay, give me the schedule, and then whatever was on the schedule for me to run, those are runs. There's no question whether I'm doing them or not. My whole way I do my work, right? Waking up at a specific time, doing I do a combination of my own productivity system, which is like the Pomodoro technique and a Kanban type of system. But basically, what it is that I work on Pomodoros. I do so many per day, and I have it planned out, and I follow that. I don't have to make a decision about what I'm going to work on and how I'm going to do my work every day. So there's a bunch of these things, and different times I implement different rules about reading a certain amount per day. I usually have a list of rules that I have at any given time that I go over when I need to until they become habit. But I try to eliminate as many decisions as possible so that I can just do what I need to do. And I think of it also as sort of like wearing two hats, right? You have this sort of manager hat, sort of the entrepreneur hat, and then you have the worker hat. And so in the entrepreneur hat, I plan out all these things. I'm like, okay, this is what I want to accomplish, this is what I want to do. And then I plan it all out. And then when I'm put on the worker hat, I just do the work. I don't question it. I don't think about what I want to do or if I should change it. I just do what I said as if the boss is telling me to do it. And so that helps a lot to eliminate those decisions.
Yeah, definitely. It's a great way because you only have so much willpower a day. It's like you wake up and it's on full charge, and then as you go through the day, like the bar goes down. And so it's just one of those great ways to be like, well, it's not about willpower. I don't need to think. There's no decision fatigue here. You kind of taken all that out of it. It's like, Steve Jobs wearing the same thing every day,
Exactly. Yeah.
kind of thing. Yeah, that's really cool. So, kind of switching back to this whole, so you retired 33. Like, walk me through that moment. You retire, you finally achieve your dream of like being on the beach and sipping Mai Tais and like living the relaxed lifestyle. And then you fell into a huge depression.
Yeah.
What happened?
So
Why?
yeah. So, I had basically made my focus of my life up to that point about retiring young. That's what I wanted to do. And, I finally hit the point and I actually went to Hawaii, to Maui for 2 months, rented this place. And I thought, okay, maybe I'm just going to live here on the beach and just relax and enjoy myself. And I actually became extremely depressed. And there's a couple of reasons for it, but one of the biggest ones, probably you've experienced this in your own life, is that when you have this really important goal and then you achieve that goal, you suddenly lose the sense of purpose that you had and drive because you don't have anything to shoot for or to look forward to. Or because when you have that goal out there, you're looking forward to this thing. And then inevitably, life is disappointing in the sense that it's never as good as what you thought it would be. Right. In fact, that's exactly how dopamine works in the brain, right? Dopamine is a brain chemical that it doesn't make you feel good, but it drives you to do things that will make you feel good, right? So you get dopamine in the anticipation of a reward, not the actual reward itself, which is quite interesting that we're wired that way. But I'd set out to do this thing, and once I had gotten there, And it's sort of like, well, this is the end. I guess this is the end. That's it. And, you know, what I realized was that it isn't the pursuit of, it isn't the thing that you get. It's what you become. That's what's important. And fulfillment comes from doing things, from moving forward, from advancing, from growing. That we are, you know, we're wired as human beings to get a sense of fulfillment and true joy out of accomplishment. That's why, for example, video games, online video games where you level up, like World of Warcraft, are so addictive, is because it's feeding right into that accomplishment. And, you know, it's that dopamine cycle that we have. And so when I got there and I was on the beach, I couldn't relax. I couldn't just do nothing, because I'd lost, you know, it didn't feel good that I anticipated that it would. And so, I hit this really just deep depression, just feeling like, okay, well, what now? And what I learned from that whole experience was that up to that point in life, and I had done this before, right? I remember one time I did this 3-month body transformation, and I was on a super strict diet, running, like just completely controlling all my calories. And I won the competition. I did this great 3-month transformation. And I remember going to like the Cheesecake Factory that night after the competition and just feeling like total crap, because what now? Now I did this thing and now I'm blowing it, and just feeling horrible because I didn't have anything to shoot for, because I had built my whole life around that thing. And so what I learned from that whole thing was that when you set goals, you have to set goals for not what you'll get, but who you'll become. Because when you set a goal for what you'll get, that's it. You get it, and that's it. And that never makes you happy. Where there's always this hedonistic treadmill where it's never as good as what you think. And then you know, the newness of a thing wears off and you adjust to that. But when you set a goal about who you become, then the goal is just, it's not the end. It's not the destiny. It's not the thing. The goal is just something that's moving you in a direction of growth. And so the goal doesn't matter, right? And that's what the truth reality in life is, that the goal doesn't matter. Because it doesn't matter, because, you know, everyone listening right now, I can guarantee you a lot of people say, well, if I had $1 million, if I made $1 million, I'd be happy. You don't know what you're talking about, John. You know, or if I had, you know, guys tell me all the time, well, if I could get really, you know, a really beautiful girl or hot girls all the time, and they, you know, they found me attractive, then, you know, whatever. Or if I get this nice car, I went through all of those things. I went through every single one of those things, from if I could not live in a cubicle anymore and I could just work from home, to if I could write a blog for a living, to if I could just make YouTube videos, or if I could just talk to people and coach them, and if I could make this amount of money. And I achieved every single one of those things. And never did I reach this point where I was like, okay, this is wonderful. It's as great as I anticipated. Not that I didn't appreciate any of those things, but what really gave me fulfillment in life was the pursuit of them, was the growth that happened internally. And so, yeah. So the big thing takeaway for me was that it's not what you get, it's who you become. And that's what goals are for. Goals are for moving you in a direction of growth.
Definitely. I think that who you become, and that sort of, you know, like, That's the most exciting thing, you know, seeing yourself embody all of these traits and like having that kind of self-esteem and that good reputation with yourself, and like, cool, I'm making an impact, I'm doing all these things, and it's not for the things. Right. It's like, it's for you, and it's for that journey. And so, kind of going off of that, I'm curious to know, is there a spiritual side to John Sonmez?
Yes, there is. It's interesting. It's changed over time. I grew up Christian. I wouldn't really call myself that anymore. I don't completely disbelieve those viewpoints, but the best way I could describe what I believe is that, well, so let me back up a little bit. Let me say that, you know, when I was an engineer, for a long time, I didn't believe any kind of woo-woo stuff, right? So people would tell me about books like Think and Grow Rich and The Power of Now and New Age stuff. I was like, nah, I don't think so. I want facts. But I've changed a lot, because what I've come to realize that's I think is really important is that it's more important to have effective beliefs than true beliefs, right? And that's, I think it's a hard pill for a lot of people to swallow, because like, no, we have to go after the truth. But whenever people say that to me, I say that, well, there is no truth in the sense that we don't know what it is. Like everything that we have in life, even in science, is all a model. It's all a model. It's not the actual truth, right? We have atomic model that's changed over years from the Bohr's atomic model to the electron cloud model, and to, you know, to realizing that it's actually not, it's just an approximation. We don't really know what it actually looks like, but it's a good enough model, right? Even mathematics, even numbers don't actually really exist. There's no concept of one in the real world. There's no concept of an actual, because, you know, I use the example of, you know, say I've got this iPod case. All right. So if I take one atom off of here, is it two now, or is it not, or, you know, I mean, like there's no true concept in reality of one. We just conceptualize numbers and we use the mathematics, and they're useful, but it's still a model. It still doesn't exist in reality. In reality, this is just a bunch of vibrations that are happening at the quantum level, and nothing, and everything is really connected. And so that kind of feeds right into really what my religious side or my spiritual philosophy is that everything is one, that we're all one, that in essence, if you want to use the word God, that we're all God, that you know, the universe is really one universal consciousness. And there's been multiple things in my life that have pointed me to that direction. I also believe that in some way we're in a simulation. I don't think it's as much of a computer simulation, but more of a mind simulation. And I think there's a reality outside this reality, and possibly nested realities. And there's a lot of things that sort of point in that direction from a lot of different sources, from Eastern philosophy to the Stoics to life experience. But one of the, you know, in Carl Jung talked about this a lot. Actually, one of my most favorite concepts of his is called synchronicity, which is a cause without an effect. And these are things that a lot of people would maybe say is a coincidence in life, but in my experience, again, we can only really go for these things on our experience. I've experienced so many of these quote coincidences in life that I believe in the concept of synchronicity. And the synchronicity doesn't make sense in this reality. If you have a singular reality that exists, but if you think about a simulation, or you think about a reality outside of reality, synchronicities make sense, because there is a cause and effect. It's just that the cause is outside of the reality, so we don't see that cause. Those things are connected. And so, you know, it's almost like the way that I talk about it sometimes is it's like a puppet show, right? If you were in a puppet theater and you see two puppets and they're moving synchronously, then you must assume there must be some hand outside that is controlling both of them. There must be some consciousness there's information that's passing between the two of them. And so that's how I see things when we have those kind of coincidences or synchronicities in this reality, is it hints to me that there's an outer reality where there's a hand, a puppet master, there's a consciousness that is passing information between those two distinct entities in this reality, of those two consciousnesses. So I don't know, that's my kind of, you know, short version of where I'm at. But, you know, I don't claim to like have absolute answers, but I think that the universe and everything is a lot bigger than what we can conceptualize.
That's trippy. Yeah, it's interesting, because like you don't know what you don't know. So the more because, you know, humans, we're just animals, right? And it's like, the more I learn about any kind of subject, the more I realize I do not know anything about this subject. And it's the same with the world and the universe, and who knows why anything is anything at the end of the day. Yeah, that's really, really interesting.
Okay.
Go on.
I was just going to say, so one, you know, interesting thing about that is like, if you think about, Because it's funny, because some people are like, will listen to what I just said, and they're like, oh, that guy's crazy. That's out there. That's like, you know, it's not, I only believe in science. But the weird thing about this, and this is kind of, you know, one thing that I ponder a lot, is that if you go back, like all the way back, you arrive at some weird, strange loop, right? Like the world has to be a strange loop. There has to be some weirdness to it, because even if you, if say from a purely scientific standpoint, okay, yeah, there was the Big Bang and all this stuff, and okay, fine, but where did the Big Bang, where did that concentrated point of matter come from, and what happened before then, right? And it's like, you can always ask a question. It's like, well, either there was a God that created it, or it came out of nowhere. Either one is really mystical. like you can't escape the mysticism of the origin of life. Like, it, does life have a, it's equally as weird for life to have a purpose as it is for it to have no purpose. Like, either one of those is extremely strange, like mystical. It doesn't make any sense. Either one of those is unbelievable. And so whatever you do, it always comes back to some kind of, you know, even if you say, well, okay, well, God created the universe. Well, what happened before God then? Or like, you know, who created God? These are all, you know, the only answer that I can come up with to any of these questions that sufficiently, you know, solves them is a strange loop, right? Which is, you know, this concept, perhaps, you know, God created the universe, or, you know, the entity, let's, you know, I think that the conceptualization of God is, it carries too many things, but let's say the supreme consciousness created the universe from his consciousness. And then through the process of creating the universe, at some point, the universe creates the supreme consciousness, right? That would be a strange loop, you know, like M.C. Escher painting.
Mm. I don't know who M.C. Escher is, but I'm going to Google that person. Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm just reading A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle. I don't know if you know it, but it basically is like complete ego deconstruction, right? Yeah. And like completely like boiling down to what is the ego, and how it's sabotaging you, essentially. And it's very interesting because when he talks about the idea of like the brain, like putting labels on things that it can't like interpret in words, because you can just like feel an experience. I think one of those interesting things in terms of spirituality is just like being in the present moment and just like accepting and being. And, you know, I think it's interesting when you balance this line of hustle and discipline and do the work, and also like enjoying the present moment and just like being, right? It's like, how do you balance that line of, I have a goal, but I'm also doing this because it's my purpose and it's to fulfill me, and I want to enjoy the journey, knowing that it might not work out, and all those kinds of things, and not letting it sort of derail you and make you depressed because you're so obsessed about the goal that you kind of forget everything else.
Yeah. So it actually ties right into the spiritual aspect of two concepts. One of them is being free from outcome, right? So, and the other one is non-attachment or acceptance, right? And they're really, really, these are all sort of different viewpoints of the same concept. Again, you know, we use labels, we use words, but you could call it non-attachment. You could call it acceptance. You could call it letting go of expectations. And those are all truths, right? This is all ways of looking at this, the same thing, which is basically to say that you're outcome independent, that, you know, the Bhagavad Gita actually said it best. There's a phrase in there where it says that you're not entitled to your labor, but only the fruits, or you're entitled to your labor, but not the fruits of your labor, which basically means like you do the work for the work's sake, and then the results either come or they don't, and you're not entitled to the results, right? Your job is just to do the work. And so that's kind of how I view it, is that it's not about the results. And really, you know, I learned this lesson at one point. I was semi-professional poker player, and I was going to go full pro poker and make a living off of poker. And what I learned, really important lesson I learned from poker, and it's actually poker and complex options trading are actually the exact same skill set, by the way, but and they have a huge number of parallels. But poker taught me that you can take the right action and get a bad result, and you can take the wrong action and get a good result, right? Which is counterintuitive to the way that we learn. And so the thing is that we have to focus on just taking right action, because, you know, the Stoics had an example of this in the archer, right? The Stoics would say that, you know, you have the archer, and you, as the archer, you draw the bow and you aim, and you aim that arrow as best as possible. But the second that that arrow leaves your fingertips, it's out of your control. And so it's up to fate. Maybe the wind takes it. Maybe it hits its target. It doesn't. But you've done everything that you can at that point, and then it's out of your control. Like trying to influence the arrow after it's left the bow is ridiculous. But we spend a lot of our lives doing that. We're worrying about the results. We're trying to influence results that we don't have control over anymore, because we truly don't have control over results. We only have control over our actions and our perceptions. And so the way that I look at it is, everything that happens in reality, I accept it, whatever it is. And it, not only do I accept it, but you know, it's kind of the concept of amor fati, the love of fate. I love it to be exactly what it is. I want it to be exactly what it is, because it's perfect, because it could be no other way. And it truly could be no other way, because as the events that have happened in this universe, it led to this exact moment. And that is the only way that the universe could be arranged at this particular point in time. Therefore, it must be the best. And so, you know, when you accept that and you learn to accept things and let go of expectation, then you can go through life and you can still have the ambition and drive, knowing that what you're doing has an influence over the results, but not direct control. And you never have direct control. And the best that you can do is the best that you can do. And then just like the archer letting go of the arrow flies on its own and it either hits the target or it's not. But your job is only to aim as good as possible, to do everything that you can, and then to rest easy, to enjoy the present moment, to let go of everything else, every expectation, and let it be whatever it is, because you don't have control over those things. And so that's kind of how I view this whole thing. And it takes time. It's hard to practice acceptance, to let go of expectations, because we're so used to having expectations. But expectations are ridiculous, whether you have them on the world, on how things should be, or you have them on other people. It's just as ridiculous to, for example, have an expectation on how someone else should behave as it is to have an expectation on the weather. You have just as little, as much control over the weather as you do about other people's behavior. And so letting go of those expectations, letting go of all those things, allows you to just focus on doing what you can, the best that you can, and then, you know, trust the process.
Yeah. And I think you learn so much from the process as well, especially if reality isn't exactly like exactly how I wished it to be. Like, it's in those moments that you learn the most often, I found. I also think that it's so much stress and anxiety could be eliminated from the world if people were just like, okay, I can't control that, so I'm just going to focus on what I can control. You know, I see it all over the place with people like watching the news now and like, oh, COVID, oh, yeah, all this kind of stuff. I'm like, bro, just like, if you're so worried about it, stay inside, wear a mask and like wash your hands. Like, what else are you going to do? Like, how are the death stats helping you? You know? So I think it's such a powerful concept, and it really just snaps you back to like, okay, this is what I'm focusing on. I'm just enjoying the process and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, and I was going to say, I wasn't always this way. Also, I had a moment. I was at a Tony Robbins seminar, actually A Date with Destiny. And he said on stage, I remember he said, the quality of your life is a direct proportion to the amount of uncertainty you can comfortably live with. And I realized I was building my whole life around certainty. I had built all these walls around myself, right, to insulate myself. I had built this fortress that I was living in, a financial one, a physical one, an emotional one. And I was trying to eliminate all that uncertainty because I wanted to control it all. I wanted to control all the results. And, you know, and I realized it was actually hurting my life, that the quality of my life was going down. And so after I left that seminar, I broke down the wall. I financially started taking risks, emotionally opened up again, because I was numb emotionally. I was basically had realized that people can't hurt me if I don't feel any emotion. And so I developed a mindset of what I call feel the pain and keep on walking, which is to say that you don't allow emotions to influence your actions, but you still allow them to be whatever they are and feel them fully. And so that was really the whole thing that moved me into this acceptance. And I developed this philosophy in life of saying, you know, I'm going to live my life and do what I want, and I will accept whatever consequences come. And that's ultimately how we have to live our life, because we don't have control over those results. And so, yeah, so that was something that really had influenced me and made me realize this, because I was spending so much of my life stressing out about things I couldn't control, trying to control all the people around me, the relationships that I had, putting expectations on people, letting them put expectations on me. And once I let go of all that, it was like the amount of negative emotions that I experience in life now is probably, it's almost nothing.
So kind of going off the idea of relationships, right? Just before I wrap this up, very curious to know, because obviously life is a human to human experience, and we're social creatures. And so relationships are very powerful, not only thinking about the compound effect of like having the right relationships, opening the right doors and the right opportunities to you, but also that sense of fulfillment, you know, those really amazing, deep, fulfilling relationships with other humans. So what I'm curious to know about is, what are some principles or philosophies that you live by when it comes to creating relationships?
So one of the big ones is what I call like leaving people better than what you found them, right? I try to always make my interactions with people as positive as possible, and to never put expectations on people, right? To just accept them, right? One real powerful thing that I read from Dale Carnegie in How to Win Friends and Influence People is he talked about this idea that if you were this person, if you had their life experiences, if you had their DNA, essentially, you know, their environment that they grew up in, you would do exactly what they are doing in this situation, and you would think exactly how they think. And so you can't really blame people for anything, because you would be exactly that person in that exact set of circumstances. And so I try to think about that when I interact with people and build relationships. And even, you know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I obviously you mentioned that I do dating coaching for guys, and that always gets a bad rap. And the thing is, like, what I try to teach guys is that they should, you know, if they're with a girl, it should be a good experience, that you should not try and just in general and use people, you know, that so many people try to like the whole thing of networking, I think gets a bad rap as well, because so many people network to see what they can get from people. And it's like, you know, if you just keep on giving, if you give value, then you're going to get value back, but you don't need to expect that. It's sort of like, you just do the thing, you just be the person. It's really more about acting out of principle than out of trying to get something. And you know, that's what I try to do and teach is to act out of principle when you're dealing with people. You know, how can you help this person? How can you, you know, be honest, being authentic, right? So sometimes that, you know, a lot of that actually means being selfish, right? So a lot of the problems I deal with guys and psychology with them is them being too much of a nice guy. And that's actually a very destructive tendency, because it means that you actually need to be more selfish, right? And it's kind of funny to say that, but if you're not taking care of yourself, like, you can't give what you don't have. And so a lot of relationships that we have with people, they're out of obligation, right? So we do things because we don't want someone to be upset, or we feel obligated in some way to do things. And those are not good relationships, right? People will perceive you as inauthentic. And so I try to be as authentic and genuine as possible by essentially putting myself first, right? So I don't do things I don't want to do. I don't say things that I don't mean. You know, if that means that I'm going to hurt someone's feelings, or that I'm going to be, quote, selfish, I'm going to do that because I'd rather be genuine and authentic. And so that's kind of how I view things. And then people appreciate that, because they know that when I do something or I say something, I'm doing it because I really want to, not because it's the polite thing to do or because I feel obligated in some way, because no one likes obligation, right? And so many relationships that I see, again, dealing with coaching a lot of guys in their relationships, their relationships out of obligation, right? They're doing things because they feel obligated, not because they actually authentically want to. And then the people that they're interacting with are doing things for them because they feel obligated as opposed to authentically wanting to do those things. So,
yeah. And that sense of obligation leads to resentment, which is the number one precursor to the breakup of any kind of relationship. It's so true. And it's interesting, because people are like, self-care, selfish, that's so bad. It's like, you know, like, yeah, like, replace the word selfish with self-care, and like, you're right, taking care of your own interests as a human, which is what you're evolutionary wired to do. It's like, the more you take care of yourself, the more you build yourself up, the more you're then actually gonna be able to give to other people, and the more you're gonna be able to like be emotionally stable to be present with others, because you've taken care of yourself and you're actually gonna have the resources to do so. So that's some really powerful stuff, John. Thank you. Yeah. The final question I'd like to ask you is, what are three key truths about the entrepreneurial journey that you would drop on a young entrepreneur today?
Okay, three key truths. Let me see. All right, I would say that, well, the one that I already mentioned, which is that you need to learn how to work without motivation. Motivation is not required for success. Let's see. Second one I would say is that, and again, I'll recap what I said before. I'll say it by saying, trust the process. Divorce the results from the process that gets those results, right? You have to become outcome independent, because entrepreneurship and life in general is a grind, and you will not always see results, and results will not always be connected to your actions. There's actually a really good book by Annie Duke called Thinking in Bets, which talks, she was a professional poker player and came across the same life philosophy, which is basically divorce the results from the actions that get those results, and just focus on taking right action. That's the key. And then, because luck is a factor as well, right, in entrepreneurship for sure. And then the third one I would say is, I'll go back to, here's what I'll say. Okay. This is what I'll say is that, Don't try. Stop trying. Instead, commit. Fully commit. Say, instead of saying, I'm going to try this, say, I'm going to make this work. Those are powerful words, because you're going to have an obstacle that's going to come across your path. It is going to happen, and it will defeat you if you're trying, because there is always going to be something stronger than you. And so if you try, then you're just going to keep on going down this path and giving up and going in a different direction. But if you say, I'm going to make it work, that's a totally different mindset. That's commitment. That says, I've burnt the boats. There's only one way, and it has to be forward. And that's what it takes, because I don't know an entrepreneur that's ever tried and made it. You fail when you try. You have to commit, and you have to say, I'm going to make this work.
Yeah, it's like when you tell yourself, oh, like, I'm going to try, something gets in your way, you kind of let yourself although you're like, well, I tried.
Exactly.
It's like, but trying doesn't mean you actually did anything, right? So it's one of those kind of like faux, like, accomplishment. Well, I tried. Such a good point. Really powerful stuff. So do you have anything that you'd like to plug? And where can people find you?
Yeah, I would say just go to bulldogmindset.com. And when you go there, you'll find a little pop-up that asks if you'd like to take the Bulldog quiz. Of course you would, because you want to know what your Bulldog score is. So I give you a score from 0 to 100. It tells you basically what your mental toughness factor is. I've got like 10 questions in there that talk about finances, how many books you read, things like that. And we'll give you a score. And then I will follow up by sending you some emails on how you can improve that score, give you an invite to my private membership, where I've got a lot of content on that. So yeah, so just go to bulldogmindset.com.
Awesome. Yeah. And definitely, go check out that quiz. I'll put it in the show notes as well. You know, I have friends who personally benefited from John's teachings, which are incredibly transformational. So do yourself a favor, go do the quiz. And thank you so much for taking the time to have this chat, John. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.
Do you ever feel like you put on a front to the world? I did an episode for this podcast with my friend Will Nedder a while back called How to Hack Yourself and Live Life to the Fullest. And we were talking all about how many, many people bottle up their emotions. They mask their true feelings and their true selves with a fake smile. Firstly, because going through hard times is not something that people typically want to hear about. And secondly, because they're afraid to show the world their true colors. One thing that I really love is that Will likes to ask people, how are you really doing? Not how are you doing, but how are you really doing? Because that then gives them permission to open up, unburden, and be unashamedly themselves and feel lighter and more liberated in the aftermath. And one day Will himself was actually going through a tough time, and he confessed to the person he was speaking to in that moment, I'm just low-key emotional. I just put on a front all the time. To which the immediate reply was, you should totally put that on a t-shirt. And boom, the low-key emotional streetwear brand was born. Will's passion for his brand truly oozes through in everything he does, and he essentially created this as a call to authenticity. A lot of us put on a front for the world of how we want the world to think about us instead of who we really are. We hide these parts of ourselves from others out of a fear that we will be judged negatively by others, or that we won't be accepted for the person that we really are. So I want to ask you, what's your front? At the end of the day, the Loki emotional brand is all about facing your truth. So if you want to wear clothes like a hoodie, a cap, a bikini that actually stand for something real and keep your hustle low-key, I have an exclusive offer just for you as my podcast listener. With me, you get a 10% discount using the discount code YAS10. That's YAS10 at the checkout at lowkeyemotional.com. All of the links and the details are in the show notes. I gotta say, I have their hoodie myself. It's extremely comfortable. It looks incredibly hip. I love wearing it. And so if you're one of the cool kids, this is most definitely for you. Again, you can get a 10% discount using the discount code YAS10. That's YAS10 at the checkout at lowkeyemotional.com. And you too will be rocking the street look in no time. Again, all of the details are in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Young Entrepreneur's Journey. This episode is recorded in London by Yasmina Ellens. The music for the show, as well as the editing, is done by Jake Babineau. If you've gotten anything out of this podcast, please consider sharing it with a friend or liking it in the iTunes store. These things help more than anything else in reaching a broader audience, and in turn, will lead to better episodes for you to listen to. Thanks again, and we'll see you in the next episode.